Well, thank you, Andy, for that powerful presentation. I think I should say buy gold stocks and go home, and then we're good to go.
That's all you need to say.
That's all I can say. But thank you, I really enjoyed it, and could make the case better. So I'm not talking any macro. I didn't have any macro plan, and did a terrific job in outlining the case of why you want exposure to gold and silver. Andy rightly said that you buy gold and silver to preserve wealth. Junior mining equities are leveraged plays on wealth preservation. So if you want to increase your wealth beyond preserving inflation or growing above inflation, junior mining equities are a great way to do that. Wanted to get the home slides. Is the mouse to move the slides? Yeah, so before I begin, I'll give my background. I discovered a stock market at 10 years old. I just thought it was the coolest thing in the world. I did a project in grade 4 in elementary school, and I was buying McDonald's, because I went to McDonald's with my dad. I was buying shares of IBM, because we had an IBM computer. Just fascinated by the stock market. Fortunately for me, I got to live my dream. I never worked a day in my life, just like Andy. I just loved the stock market. Got a job at 21, working as an institutional money manager. Worked my way up to a senior partner in an investment firm. I was running about $1.5 billion, one of the best hedge funds in Canada at the time. Top of my game, living the dream of my dream job. And I had three girls at the time. And then I had the blessing and surprise of finding out my wife was pregnant with twins.
Oh.
So I had potentially five girls under the age of 8 years old staring me in the eyes. And I was working 60, 70 hours a week. I was traveling all over meeting companies. And I made the hard decision to basically quit the job that I dreamed about having since I was 10 years old, cold turkey, to be a good dad. So I think if I'm gonna fail at one thing in life, I don't wanna fail as a father and a husband. So I decided to do that and walk away. But a really hard decision because I really obviously love my job. At 2015, I started buying gold stocks. I started buying commodity stocks in 1997. Oil and gas went almost 10 bucks a barrel. So I was gonna go to $5 a barrel. It went to $140 a barrel. So I learned my first lesson in contrarian investing. So professionally, that fund I was running, I started investing heavily in gold in 2015 when gold was $1,100 an ounce. The headline said it's a relic, it's a pet rock. It no longer has any value. And I saw extreme value in the sector. Barrick was almost going bankrupt, I think Valley was almost going bankrupt. The sector was in total disarray, and I saw a huge opportunity. So I was investing professionally in gold. I got the gold bug in 2015, quit my job in 2018. I'm sitting at home with twins in my arms and bored, because I was used to working 60 hours a week. I was having a great time being a dad. And I said, I think gold's gonna go up a heck of a lot. How can I make the most money possible if I'm right on my call, like Andy has been bullish on gold? I said, the most leverage you have to gold is in microcap mining stocks, the Wild West of investing. I had never done that professionally. I always invested in producing assets, in institutional quality names for my customers. But I said, gold's going up a lot. I want to take maximum leverage. And I also realized that it was a very poorly researched space. It was kind of like the Wild West of gambling and speculation. I said, I want to take an institutional approach. I want to take my lens of an institutional investor and apply it to a very poorly researched, poorly understood part of the market. And so I asked myself, how am I going to do that in a structured basis? And I said, well, most of you are familiar with the venture capital model. Anybody invested in a tech venture capital fund before, or a biotech venture capital fund before? A very proven model for investing. You buy 30 companies in Silicon Valley, 29 of them are disasters you never hear about, and there's one Amazon, there's one Facebook, there's one Google that goes up 50,000% and you end up with really good returns. And lots of people throw billions, if not trillions of dollars at this space. And I said to myself, what? The junior mining space has a very similar risk-reward paradigm. You have thousands of companies, most of them go to zero, but the ones that are truly exceptional that find mines end up going up thousands of percent. So why is not anybody adopting the same approach to junior mining and doing it venture capital? And so just to give you a mathematical example just to understand my madness, if you have 10 stocks in your portfolio and you have one stock that goes up 5,000%. So that's the one that you buy as a junior mining exploration company, makes a discovery, goes to becoming a mine. You made 5,000% of your investment. You have another stock that makes a really great discovery, it's pretty close to being a mine, the market adopts, goes up 1,000%. And your other 8 stocks go to zero. Okay, my sister's a doctor, she's a lot smarter than me. If she kills 8 out of 10 of her patients, she'll be out of business very, very fast. So I said, I'm not as smart as her. Let me find a job where I can be wrong 8 times out of 10 and still get invited by Andy to come speak at his conference. That's a pretty good deal. So that's what I do. And so looking at this model, I said, well, if that's the case, everybody would do it. So if you could just buy 10 stocks tomorrow on the Toronto Stock Exchange, Venture Exchange, and 2 out of 10 would do that, we'd all be rich. But the sad reality is, if you took, 1,000 stocks on the TSX Venture Exchange, you'd be lucky if maybe 5 of them actually become mines. So finding those 2 winning stocks is a lot harder than it looks, and you can't leave it to chance. And I know right now everybody's feeling good and we're in a bull market, so everybody thinks all their stocks are amazing, they're all going up, I want to break it to you, you know, don't confuse a bull market with intelligence, right? So in a rising tide, all boats will lift. When the tide goes out, as Warren Buffett says, you see who's swimming naked. In those cases, you're gonna see which deposits are actually mines and which ones actually went up because the market went up, and they'll go back down when the market goes back down. So what I tried to do is try to come up with a structured approach to how do I improve the hit rate? How do I increase my odds from 5 in 1,000 to 2 in 10? And what I did is I created a junior mining checklist. And again, I didn't just make this up. I've invested in producing mining companies for close to 20 years. So I said, okay, I'm new to the junior resource, speculative part of the market. Let me reverse engineer. What are all the traits that made the producing mines that I've owned for decades in my portfolio mines? And what are things that prevent them from becoming mines? And I have two buckets of lists, and I'm not gonna go into tremendous detail because it's too much, but I'll give you kind of high level overview. There's two lists, things that you cannot change. So basically it's Mother Nature. You can't change the grade of the deposit, you can't change the metallurgy of the deposit, you can't change the scale, you can't change the infrastructure that's already in place, and you can't change the jurisdiction. So that's Mother Nature, you gotta deal with the cards you've been given. So the first one is grade. In very simple terms, grade is margin. If you're selling hamburgers for $10 and it costs you a dollar to make them, you're making $9 a burger, you're making 90% margin. So in any business, the higher margins you have, the more cash flow you have to pay your employees, the more cash flow you have to have a profitable business. So very simple terms, the higher the grade, the better. Open pit and underground are very different situations. There's a lot of nuances between that, but in general, if you have an underground mine, you want the highest grade possible. Open pit mine, highest grade possible. There's things like strip ratio, how deep the deposit can be. We can go into details later. But in general, the higher grade, the more margin you have to play with, the better. Second thing, a lot of investors ignore this, is metallurgy. This is when the rubber hits the road and you're trying to build a mine. You might have a deposit that's 5 grams per ton, but the metallurgy is how much of that gold you can actually get out once it's through the mill and through the refining process. And sometimes it can be as low as 30, 40%. So if you start with 5 grams, you only end up at 2.5 grams by the time you're done with the process, you've lost 50% of your gold. And so be very, very careful in the metallurgy. Many investors ignore this, and complex metallurgy also means you might have to put an extra lot of capital in to extract that gold or silver or copper, and it makes it much more costly and less effective returns. The third point is scale. So you can have really good margins, you can have good recoveries, but like any business, you have to have enough volume. Andy's gotta sell a lot of gold every quarter, every month to pay his bills. Assuming if he's selling one gold bar a month, he's not gonna be busy very long. So you gotta have enough throughput to have the cash flow to cover your capital costs. And this business is very simple. It's very complex to build a mine, but you take how much gold you're producing, what your margins are, that's your cash flow, and how much you're producing every single year, and that divided by how much it costs to put the mine into production will determine whether the mine is gonna be producing acid or not. So if you're generating $200 million a year of cash flow, and your mine costs you $100 million to build, you're getting your money back in 6 months. That's a business I wanna invest in all day long. If you're pulling out $50 million of cash flow, and you got $1 billion of CapEx, that's a 20-year payback. You would not invest in that business. So that combination of margin and scale will give you the idea of economics. Infrastructure is what I've been writing a lot about recently. Again, investors overlook this. They often get very excited about the new discovery. How many ounces is it? You know, how big can it get? They don't differentiate between finding a mine in Siberia or, you know, northern Canada somewhere, or finding a mine in Quebec or Ontario where you're full of roads, power, infrastructure, and existing mills. What this means is if you find a deposit right next door to an existing mill, or you find a deposit next to a highway where there's a power or there's ports or there's roads, you don't have to put that infrastructure in. So when you have a 5 million ounce deposit in the middle of nowhere, you might have to put in $2 billion of capital to bring the roads and the power and the infrastructure necessary to get that mine to production. That's all added to your bill on the payback of that mine. So infrastructure is something I highly value. And again, investors get caught up about the size of discovery or the drill results, but understanding how much capital it's gonna cost to get to production is huge, and infrastructure is a key part of that. And then finally, jurisdiction. This is another one that investors are very polarizing with. Some people say, I only invest in the USA, I only invest in Canada, I never invest in a foreign jurisdiction. For me, I look at jurisdiction on a case-by-case basis. What do I mean by that? Well, I love Canada, I'm from Canada, I'm a little frustrated with it these days, but I still love my country. In Canada, it's become atrocious. It can go take up to 20 to 25 years from first discovery to build a mine. So yes, Canada is a very good jurisdiction. I have a vast majority of my portfolio in Canada, but if it takes you 25 years to bring a mine to production, the present value of that cash flow today is very, very low. West Africa is the other side of the equation, right? So like Mali, Burkina Faso right now, they're very politically sensitive areas, dangerous areas to operate. You make a discovery in West Africa today, you can be production in 5 years. So it's a trade-off between security of ownership security of taxation versus how long it's going to take to build a mine. As an aside, I know we're in Atlanta today, and I love the United States. Your government does a lot of things right, there's something wrong. They're doing incredible work in mining right now. I have never seen a government so focused on reducing timelines, expediting permitting processes, getting those metals. I think it's a lot to do with what Andy's saying, in terms of they know these metals are critical to the economy, to the monetization of the dollar, and so they are moving at warp speed. And so the permitting timelines are extremely important. Security of fiscal regime and ownership. I will not invest in a country where I have fear that I own the mine today and I don't own it tomorrow. So if you ever have any fears of nationalization or expropriation, that's a very difficult thing to deal with. And then finally, social license, extremely important. You can be in a great jurisdiction of Canada or the US or Europe or wherever you want to be, and if the local community does not want the mine, it's not happening. And so if you've got a golf club or, you know, luxury vacation homes within a golf chip shot of your mining project, forget it. If you're in a place that's very hostile, a lot of activists, ESG-based activists, that can stop a project literally in its tracks. And so I'm really interested in investing in mines, and so if I see risk of project being frozen, I'm not likely to invest in it. The second part of my list is, what can you actually change? So we talked about things you can't change. These are things that hypothetically you can change in a junior mining company. One is management. Don't worry, CEOs in the room, you're all here, you're all safe. We're not going after you today. Insider ownership is something that you can change. It's very important to me. Capital efficiency, cap table, and valuation. So I've done probably, I'm guessing, like 10,000 or more one-on-one meetings with management in my 25-year career. I have never had a management meeting where the management team does not start off by telling me how amazing their management team is. Every single company has told me they have an incredible management team and incredible board. So mathematically speaking, that's impossible, because there's 10,000 companies, and they're all amazing, and nobody's bad, then who's good and who's not? So I've come up with three simple criteria that I look for in a junior mining company that helps me elevate them from being amazing to maybe being really, really good. First one is economic geologists. So what do I mean by that? I love stocks. I've been addicted to the stock market since I was 10 years old. Geologists love rocks. Okay, they just love them. They love drilling for them. They love looking at them. They love eyeing them, watering them down, checking for visible gold. They love rocks. So most geologists love to drill the chase. They love to drill. And so if you give a geologist $3 million, he's going to want to spend 10. If you give me $100, I want to invest 120 on margin in the stock market. That's what I do. I understand geology. I understand how their mind works. It's a different passion. So what I like is a geologist that comes to me and says, look, here's my $3 million drill budget. I have this theory about structural controls. There's going to be an economic deposit here. I'm going to stick 10 holes in. It's going to cost me $3 million. If the first two holes go in, and he or she's scratching his head and saying, it's not quite looking like I thought, I'm not sure I was right, give me the other $2.7 million back. Don't drill into 8 more holes and then tell me, we didn't find anything, but we learned a lot about geology. We've got a really good structural understanding of the lithology here. It's a really fun educational experience. I want to make money. I want to build mines. I want to have a profitable business. And so a geologist that loves rocks enough and loves making money enough to say, I'm going to hand back the money. I'm not getting what I'm liking, what I'm seeing. And I'm going to try my B target or my next target or one after that, or wait for a better day. Second one. Most junior mining companies are run by geologists, and God bless them. You do not want Michael Gentile spotting your drill holes in the drill program. That will be an epic disaster. But you also do not want to have a junior mining company that is solely run by geologists, because oftentimes they're not the best business people, or they haven't learned the best business practices. So for me, the ideal combination of junior mining company is an economic geologist with a partner or a board or a management team member who has strong knowledge of capital markets. And that's, I think, what I've been able to add a lot of value in the space, is that synergy is really special when it works well and when each person knows the value to bring to the table. A lot of really profitable mines or really potential profitable businesses have been destroyed by bad decisions on financing, on structure, on strategy. So you end up with the saddest thing in junior mining is when you have a mine and your shareholders don't make any money. That to me, you can understand looking for a deposit and you don't find it, part of the game. When you actually find an economic deposit, you get into production and your shareholders have like a 2% cumulative compound annual return over 25 years, that's a tragedy, and that's because oftentimes they've badly navigated the capital markets and financial decisions have diluted shareholders down to a point where they haven't made real money. And then thirdly, strong engaged board, and I'll talk a bit more about that as to why I think that's extremely important, and this comes down to insider ownership. So in a junior mining company, you want a strong engaged board. Most junior mining companies, when they're small, I invest in companies that are sub $50 million, they may have 2 or 3 full-time employees, if they're lucky. Probably consultants, a few on the side, but 2 or 3 full-time employees. They probably have 6 or 7 board members. And so the board members outnumber the full-time employees by 2-1 or 3-1 in that case. And so most boards are highly qualified. I'm on six boards myself. Most of my fellow board members are extremely capable and very talented individuals. What dictates me wanting to spend 4 hours a quarter versus 10 hours a week as a board member? Insider ownership. If you own 5, 10, 15% of the company and you're a board member, you're not checking in once every 3 months and calling the CEO a couple times a quarter to see how they're doing. You're probably calling them every single day. And a lot of you in the room are companies I own, you know I probably text you or call you every single day. And it's not because I love you guys, which I do, it's because I own large portions of your company and I want to know what's going on and I want to know how I can help the company be successful. So in junior mining, as you know, there's also a lot of bad behavior, unfortunately, in the business from a national perspective. And so insider ownership is also an excellent governor of that. If you have big owners on your board and your management team, they're going to think like owners, they're going to want to protect shareholders, and they're going to think about shareholder value creation versus potentially their own interest. Next one is capital efficiency. So I mentioned the story of a really successful company, that a successful mine ends up going into production and nobody makes any money. And the reason typically is capital efficiency. And so what do I mean by that is, you know, junior mining is, there's some people in the room that are very tenacious, and you have to be very tenacious and persistent to be in this business and stick to it. But they also know that you don't discover a mine on your first drill hole. It's very, very rare that you step up, first drill hole, boom, it's a mine, and you're front page of the newspaper. Typically takes years and years and years of hard work and persistence and raising money. And so I love stories where a CEO comes to me and says, look, I want to raise $3 million, and Brian at Astra's here, got a new project in Argentina, Mike, I think it's really got great prospects. I want to raise $2 million. If my theory is right, the system's much bigger than I think, and we're going to know very, 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 very soon if we're right or wrong. So spend a little bit of money and get an instant answer whether you've got something that's real or not. So fail quickly and fail with a limited amount of dollars versus projects that take, you know, 5 to 10 years of systematic exploration. That's dilution. That's millions and billions of shares being issued to get to the point where you can make that decision. So I like to have small dollar amounts, yes or no answers. But we'll talk about this, you know. Fail quickly, small dollar amounts, yes or no answers, and where am I going to be on the next financing? What information am I going to get from this drill program or this theory that you have that's going to allow investors to pay a higher price in the future for those shares, less dilution, and get us an answer closer to an economic mine? Another thing I like to look at too is drill costs. So remember I talked about infrastructure and how I really like infrastructure. If you don't have time or don't want to know if a company is in a great infrastructure position, let's say in a different country, you don't know the area that well, drill costs are an excellent thermometer of how much infrastructure you have. If a company is spending $150 a meter to drill, I bet one of my kids that they have great infrastructure in that area because you can drive to the site, rigs are available, it's easy access. If it costs $1,000 a meter or $1,500 a meter and you're flying a helicopter off the side of a mountain at a, you know, 62 degree angle, probably the drill costs are going to be very high. And what that means for me is that if you have $1,000 drill cost per meter versus $100 drill cost per meter, you get 10 times the meters for the same level of spending in a low-cost drill location versus a high-cost location. Doesn't mean I won't invest in those companies, but they better find a heck of a lot of gold per hole. They're spending 5 to 10 times per meter the drill costs of a company that has advantage infrastructure or lower costs. Okay, the cap table. I often get the question, well, Michael, you're in the business, you have lots of connections, you have a great network. How do I know if management is good or not? Right, how do I know if management is taking care of me as a shareholder? I don't have the ability to call people and do reference checks like you do. So I say, okay, fine, show me the cap table. Show me the shareholder register. It's always in the presentation. It's at the front if they're happy about it, or to the back of the presentation if they're trying to hide it. Find that cap table, look at it, and look for some red flags. So I call the cap table my x-ray machine. You know, if you have a broken leg or broken ankle, you take an x-ray, you can see right away if the leg is broken or not. You look at the cap table, I can tell you if they've got a bit of a broken attitude toward their shareholders. So I won't go through all of them because there's a lot of stuff here, but stuff that really ticks me off or turns me off a story is pen and paper. So, you know, you come to me, I've had so many phone calls the last 5 years. I started a mining company 3 months ago, got some great land in Ontario, Quebec. We want to drill. It's like, great, what's the valuation? Well, we're selling shares for 50 cents a share. My next question is, well, what did you get your shares for? And they tell me, oh, we've got shares for half a cent or a penny. They have no money. They have no money to drill the project. They can't afford to move on without my capital, but they want a 50 times return. Just for the sake of putting a project together. I don't mind founders getting paper, I don't mind them having sweat equity and being involved, but if the project can't move forward without my capital, you can't have 50 times a return before you make a discovery. So penny paper is something I look at very carefully. I want to understand what's the delta between what you're paying and I'm paying, because I want to be aligned with management. I don't want them to have high insider ownership because they got all the shares for free and I'm giving the money. I want to have that alignment of putting real cash in the company alongside me as investor. Another one I don't like is, I mentioned, there's only 2 or 3 full-time employees in a junior mining company, and I see they have 1,000 founders, right? That's every single stockbroker in Vancouver, their grandmother, their best friends, their high school friend, their gym teacher, their hockey coach. They're all in the company. They're all founders rounds. So I want founder paper going to founders. I want founders who are going to sweat every day discussing this to have that. Everyone else can buy alongside me on the private placement that they're coming to me asking for money for. Massive amount of warrants. So if you see a company has 200 million shares outstanding and they have 200 million warrants, that probably means they've had a very hard time raising money. They probably raised money from the wrong type of investors. And for those of you who don't understand how warrants work, if you sell a share at 10 cents and the warrants at 15 cents, well, as soon as the stock is 17 cents or 18 cents, those hundreds of millions of warrants will get exercised and sold back in the market. So I like clean cap tables if possible. Flow-through financings in Canada, it's another pet peeve of mine. A convertible debt. Junior mining companies don't generate cash flow. They burn cash for years and years on end. You should never have debt on a business that burns cash, because if the second the tide goes out or the market rolls over, you can't pay off your debt, that's how you lose your business, that's how you lose 100% of your assets. Okay, so you guys all know Pierre Lassonde. I'm sure Andy called Pierre Lassonde as the first choice. He said no tonight, unfortunately, so you got me instead. But Pierre Lassonde is a legend. Obviously, I'm not worthy to tie his shoelaces, but I did, in all humility, attach my name to him because I love the Lassonde curve. It's obviously well discussed in the industry, but I do think, I mean, Pierre knows this, he just didn't include it, but it's very, very important timing of cycles. So I mentioned earlier my first investment in commodities is in oil in 1997. When oil was $10 a barrel, people said it was going to go to $5. It went to $140. That was a period where sentiment in oil was extremely negative. So the yellow line here is a normal valuation. The market's not too hot, not too cold. It's got the average valuation of each company along the stage of the Lassonde curve. The blue line would be when the market sentiment is really, really bad. So think about 2015 when people saying gold was a pet rock and nobody cared about the sector, Barrick is going bankrupt. So any company along the Lassonde curve was trading at like 50 to 70% cheaper than a normal median valuation of time. And then the red line is where lithium was maybe 3-4 years ago when it went up like 10,000% in 6 months. It's red, red hot. You know, Moose Pasture in Ontario was trading for $100 million market cap because it might have lithium. Okay, so that's the range of outcomes. So what I try to do when I make an investment is I want to invest between the blue and the yellow. I want to be aggressively allocating capital and accumulating shares and doing financing between the blue and the yellow because I believe the sector is going to go from extreme pessimism to positivity. And my time horizon when I invest is 5 to 10 years. So I own massive stakes in junior mining companies. I never sell. I'm a private equity-based investor. So while I'm writing a check today, I'm buying gold today, and I agree very much with Andy's thesis, I think gold's got a 5 to 10 year run ahead of it. Because I have, that's still how long my horizon is. And I still believe, despite the slightly better markets we have, we're still somewhere between the blue and the yellow in terms of valuation. We can talk about that in Q&A. So I will not invest when I see red, because red to me is a very dangerous place to be. If I think the commodity is going down, you're not gonna make money. I learned the hard way in oil and gas when oil went from $140 to $35 a barrel. I'm a very good stock picker. I lost 75% of my money, and the guy who's a bad stock picker lost 95. That doesn't make you feel very good. So if the commodity is going down, you're going to lose money. So you've got to understand where we are in the cycle. Is the outlook positive? Deploy here. And why is that important? Because if I buy a company that's got a PEA or a resource over here, and they don't advance the project at all, the Lassonde curve, but the sentiment goes from negative to positive, I might have made 5 to 10 times my money before they even drill an additional drill hole, before they find an extra ounce of gold, before they do anything on the Lassonde curve to add value. Your starting life over here, you can lose a heck of a lot of money even if you've moved along the Lassonde curve to create value for your shareholders. I often get the question of how I allocate capital. So again, I'm trying to bring a institutional, kind of scientific approach to junior mining investing, which is not often the case in this sector. And so if I like a company, I'll allocate 1% of my net worth to that investment. I'm a little bit like Andy, I'm all in. I have like 90% of my net worth in junior mining equities. I'm a little extreme, I don't recommend that maybe all you guys do that, but that's where I'm at. So I'll take 1% of my net worth and make an initial investment in that company. If they are delivering and executing well, in my mind when I'm writing my first check, I've already kind of pre-allocated up to 5% of my net worth on subsequent financings because these companies need money periodically. And so I'm already writing 4 or 5 checks in my mind on the future financings to come. If they're doing what they say they're gonna do, they're following my checklist and they're executing well. And so I'm targeting 5 to maybe up to 30% ownership position in that company on my first investment. So by default, I am in very small companies. Like my first check will be anywhere on a $50 million market cap company or less. I want to be big, I want to be long-term, and I want to be helpful and influential for that company. So having those big stakes helps me have that influence and that voice on the management and the board of the company. And I'm targeting 20 to 50 times my money on my initial check. So if you, there's a lot of really good stories that I meet, and sometimes managers don't understand why I'm saying no. I've had many meetings where I go, I like your story, your stock's going up, but I'm not investing. What do you mean? My stock's going up, why don't you give me money? I say, well, because I'm looking for this. I'm looking for that 20 to 50 times off my initial check. And why am I looking for that? Because I kill 8 out of 10 of my patients, right? They're 8 out of 10 of my stocks, mathematically speaking, over time, will go to zero over a full cycle because they're not going to find a mine. And so I need those big winners to pay for all the losers that I'm going to have over a full cycle. Without that, I will not have good returns. Okay, so I also get the question of when I sell. So I start off with 1% of my capital. If the company is not executing well, they're making decisions I disagree with, the geology unfortunately is not there, they don't make the discovery I'm hoping for, the deposit's not big enough, the grade is not there, I basically stop putting money in the company. So again, mathematically, if I make a bad investment, or just bad luck, or it doesn't work out, the most I can lose is 1% of my capital. Okay, so that's how I protect myself from losing too much money. My favorite scenario is actually putting in money at a higher price, because that means that my first investment, the theory is working, the company's having success, and I'm averaging up into my investment, not averaging down. I find most investors in general in the space, they pull out their flowers and they water their weeds. So what I mean by that is they sell their winners and they keep their dogs in the portfolio. And then they wake up 15 years later, they have a portfolio full of really crappy companies. They go, why does my portfolio suck? It's because you pull all your winners out and you kept the losers. And in this business, if you're not making, if you're in this room and buying a junior mining stock and your goal is to make 30% of your investment, you're in the wrong room. You should, if you're buying these stocks, they're highly risky, they're very leveraged bets on the commodity. You need to make a lot of money if you're right to pay your errors. So if you're selling your winners and keeping your losers or adding to your losers, you're gonna have with very few stocks to go up 50 times and have a lot of stocks to go down, your portfolio is not gonna look very good. My more happy circumstances when I sell is takeover bid. If I'm doing my job identifying companies that have potential to become mines, then some large companies will want to be buying them at some point in time. I've been fortunate the last six years, I've had 5 or 6 takeovers in my portfolio. So I'm happy to see that my process is working. Second way I would sell would be, it doesn't get sold to a major mining company, but it goes all the way through the Lassonde curve and is now a major mining company, goes into production or is soon to be in production, TSX main board listed, multi-billion dollar market cap company, lots of liquidity, or it goes all the way to become a producing asset. So those are the three ways that I would exit. This slide is, as most of you, some of you know me, I'm a pretty humble guy. This is not to say, look how good my portfolio is, but it's more to show you, my dad's a math teacher, so you can sell a bit of that influence he had on me to see the math and the science in my presentation, but this is to show you, mathematically speaking, how my portfolio looks. So I usually do about 5 deals per year. So I'll meet probably 500 mining companies a year, and I'll invest in 5. So I'm very, very selective. So over the last 8 years I've been doing this, I have 40 stocks in my portfolio. And you can see, to my process, I have several stocks that have gone up over 1,000%. Those are the epic winners that are gonna drive the vast majority of my return. And you can also see that, I don't know, maybe half of my portfolio hasn't done anything. And the only reason why there's not a lot of negative bars here into the loser column is because we're in a rising market. I've timed the cycle well on that Gentile Lassonde curve, so everything is up. But these are the ones that have sort of been disappointing. And in a bear market, it'd be down 50%, but in a bull market, they're sort of flat. But my overall portfolio return has been close to 2,000%. The GDXJ, which is bigger companies, is 400%. And the TSX Venture, which is really my proxy, is up 100%. So showing that that's just this disciplined, systematic process is yielding good results. This one shows you graphically. I do not like investing on the Lassonde curve in the pre-discovery phase. That is probably like the riskiest phase of drilling. You have a brand new piece of land. No one's ever drilled a hole there before. Like 99 out of 100 of those are not going to make economic discovery. So why I've invested post-exploration into discovery is the market has been so bad the last 8 years that I can buy on that Lassonde curve post-discovery with information in hand at the valuations typically in a normal market that you pay for a greenfield exploration play. So if you look at my portfolio, about 90% of my investments are all post-discovery, and the vast majority between post-discovery resource all the way to pre-FS. And I have a couple of gold producers, and the only reason why I have those is because those are companies that got acquired that were exploration assets that became producing assets. So basically all my portfolio was between discovery phase and pre-production, and that 90% of my portfolio is there, with a few exceptions on the exploration phase that I really can't help myself, and I think they're going to be great potential discoveries going forward. Just want to give you a few visual examples. I'm almost done. K92 Mining is one of the first juniors I bought, 2017, 2018. It was like a $20 million market cap. They're in Papua New Guinea, which is not a tier one location from a politics perspective, but a tier one geological location. I invested in the company when they were just about to make their first discovery in Papua New Guinea. They had an incredible discovery hole. They then brought in a new management team. So the company was run pretty poorly before, and they brought in a grizzly operator who's been through many, many cycles in many, many jurisdictions. Turned the company around, made a massive discovery, and you can see those four green bars there. The market was so bad that the company was making tremendous progress along the Lassonde curve, rapidly growing their deposit, and the market did not care. So I was consistently adding to my position, you know, quarter after quarter, year after year. The company hit that inflection point, went into production, and is now about a $7 billion company. It's been a fantastic stock. Norris Superior, another example. I never mention anything about price. I don't add because the stock is up. I add when the company is making progress on their journey through the Lassonde curve and through the steps that they've taken through to become producing mine. So Norris Superior is a company, I'm the largest shareholder and the board member. I bought in 2017 when they had 600,000 ounces. Along the way, they consolidated a major mining camp in Quebec. By the time 2023 rolls around, they went from 600,000 ounces to 4 million ounces, and the stock was the exact same price that I had it in 2017. And so you might say, well, that's really frustrating. But to me, as you can tell, I couldn't stop buying it because the company was adding so much value. Just the market was very negative and not responding to the value proposition. And then, you know, fortunately in 2025, as the company fully consolidated the camp, the market started to recognize the value of the asset, and it was acquired last year by IAM Gold for about $400 million. Last example, North Isle Copper and Gold. You can see a similar theme. I bought it in 2020. Company brought in a new CEO, fantastic management team and board, turned the asset around. New discoveries, preliminary economic assessment, driving the de-risking of the asset from a permitting and feasibility perspective, and the stock did basically nothing for much of the last 4 years. I think I invested 7 times over the course of the years. And finally, in 2024, 2025, they put out a fabulous economic assessment. The market finally latched on to the idea, and the stock has gone up, you know, close to 10 to 20 times since I bought it initially. So again, these are not to say, look at these great stocks that I bought, to show you my systematic and disciplined approach to investing in the sector. For those of you, I often get a lot of questions. I'm on YouTube, not as much as Andy. That's really impressive, Andy. I don't know how you do that in interviews. That's exhausting. I do one or two a week and I'm tired, so kudos to you. I started a newsletter in October. It's called SaturdayMorningMining.com. If you go to that website, it's not investment advice. Full disclaimer, nowhere in the US, don't sue me. It's not investment advice. It's not recommendations to buy or sell. What I talk about is every company in my portfolio, if there's news that week, I'll put a summary, try to translate it to plain English from geology speak. Any videos, interviews I'm doing, any conferences I'm attending like this one, I'll talk about it. So if you want to keep up on what I'm doing, you know, what I own in my portfolio, what I'm excited about, you can sign up for free at SaturdayMorningMining.com. That's it for me. I have some other slides for questions, but I'll stop here for now. Thank you very much.